Yesterday, after our session on leaving Egypt and Israel's remembering their history, Jim White handed me a little piece of paper, and he had several quotes about historians and history, and I'd like to read you one. This is originally from a French book by Paul Valery. I won't attempt to pronounce it. It was printed in Paris in 1949, but it's quoted by David Hackett Fisher in a book called Historian's Fallacies. History is the most dangerous product which is the chemistry of the which the chemistry of the mind has concocted. Its properties are well known. It produces dreams and drunkenness. It fills people with false memories, exaggerates their reactions, exacerbates old grievances, torments them in their repose, and encourages either a delirium of grandeur or a delusion of persecution. It makes whole nations bitter, arrogant, insufferable, and vainglorious. History will justify anything. It teaches precisely nothing, for it contains everything and furnishes examples for everything. Whew.
Yeah.
Israel's memory, corporate memory, of their time in the wilderness was terribly important. How did Israel, do you know how Israel viewed its time in the wilderness? From any of the reading that you've done, good time or bad time? Bad time? Both? How both?
I'll buy both.
You'll buy both, okay. In what way was it good and in what way was it bad? Yeah, Israel, in the wilderness, Israel seems to have achieved a new zenith in their ability to gripe. And, you know, some of the great griping passages in the Old Testament come out of the time when they were wandering around in the wilderness. Again, I want to begin today by reading from the book These Stones Will Shout about the wilderness. I don't know if you know anything about the wilderness in Palestine. Their idea of wilderness is different than ours. You came to Holden Village to experience maybe some of the wilderness, and the North American wilderness is substantially different than the Judean wilderness. Into the desert. Moses and the people stayed at Mount Sinai for about a year. Then they broke camp and set out into the desert in search of the land that Yahweh promised them. The desert into which the Hebrew people caravans went was made up of three regions: stretches of sand where nothing grew, expanses of rock with an occasional spring, and patches of semi-arid land with just enough growth to nourish sheep and goats. The vast wilderness of sand and rock became the stage for the 40-year-long drama of Israelite history that now began. The fourth book of the Bible, the book of Numbers, narrates it with disarming candor and honesty. Once the Israelites penetrated the desert, discouragement set in. The honeymoon days of Mount Sinai quickly faded. Any desert traveler who has experienced the blazing heat of the Sinai can understand the Israelite reaction. The sun beats down torridly, and the oven-hot winds of the Khamsin take their toll on even the hardiest nomad. This does not excuse the Israelite reaction, but it does help us appreciate why the people began to hanker for the green fields of the Nile Delta. The desert. What kind of things did Israel learn in the desert? I suppose you already know, you know, what we're going to be talking about. The title of this section, this session, is A New Dependency. And so you can understand that there were lessons of dependency. But when you're in the desert, you know, some of the luxuries that you have when you talk about that you will be the one setting the agenda. The desert sets the agenda. You have a new feeling of helplessness, of exposure, hopelessness, and the cry for daily bread becomes really one of great passion. And so when the children of Israel first set out into the desert and they made that covenant with God on Mount Sinai, and they promised that they would live by whatever came from the hand of God, I'm sure that they began, well, the record shows that it wasn't very long, and they began to have doubts, as sometimes we do too, whether that is going to be enough. and whether there will be food for tomorrow. A hymn which reflects the experience of Israel in our Christian faith is hymn 343, Guide Me, Ever Great Redeemer. I'd like to read two verses of that. Guide me, ever great Redeemer, pilgrim through this barren land. I am weak, but you are mighty. Hold me with your powerful hand. Bread of heaven, feed me now and evermore, feed me now and evermore. Open now the crystal fountain where the healing waters flow. Let the fire and cloudy pillar lead me all my journey through. Strong deliverer, shield me with your mighty arm. Shield me with your mighty arm. Great hymn talks about the dependence that Israel came to have out in the wilderness. I'd like to turn to the book of Deuteronomy. Deuteronomy, you remember, was a book 26 chapters long. It's the reflection of Moses right before the crossing of the Jordan River. And it's a great book, and it really embodies a lot of the theology that we've been talking about yesterday, today, and even tomorrow. And it's a pause. They're just about to enter the promised land, and Moses stops, and he, for 26 chapters, he wants them to reflect about the experience of leaving Egypt, the experience of the wilderness, and the dangers of going into the promised land. And so, you know, while there are probably many people who are anxious to just get going and move on in, Moses really has some very important words here. And as a matter of fact, the book of Deuteronomy, do you know anything about King Josiah and the Josiah reforms? We talked yesterday we're wondering the strong words about the Passover. And it said, if anyone fails to do this, if he has leavened bread in his house, let him be cut off from the community of Israel and treated as an outsider. And those struck us as very strong. But it's very soon that the Passover is neglected. And by the time of King Josiah, people hadn't been celebrating the Passover for hundreds of years. And finally, someone stumbles across the book of Deuteronomy in the temple. And it's read, and King Josiah hears it, and the great reform movement takes place in the community of Israel, and they try and reinstitute all of the early days of their faith. And they began to look at the time in the wilderness as a time when God was really wooing them, when he called them out into the wilderness and began to form them as his own people. And they look back on that with a great deal of longing. Deuteronomy chapter 8. Could someone read that, please? 1-6.
All the commandments which I command you this day you shall be careful to do, that you may live and multiply, and go in and possess the land which the Lord swore to give to your fathers. And you shall remember all the way which the Lord your God has led you these 40 years in the wilderness, that he might humble you, testing you to know what was in your heart, whether you would keep his commandments or not. And he humbled you and let you hunger, and fed you with manna, which you did not know, nor did your fathers know, that he might make you know that man does not live by bread alone, but that man lives by everything that proceeds out of the mouth of the Lord. Your clothing did not wear out upon you, and your foot did not swell these 40 years. Know then in your heart that as a man disciplines his son, the Lord your God disciplines you. So you shall keep the commandments of the Lord your God by walking in his ways and by fearing him.
Okay. What are the lessons of the wilderness?
Discipline.
Partly the Yahweh has taken them out into that wilderness to discipline them. What else have they learned?
Humility.
Humility.
But they've also learned God's provision.
Yeah, he takes care of them.
Okay.
He's with them every step of the way.
That's partly the lesson of humility. God's taking care of them. When you're out in the wilderness, and we're going to take a look at the manna lesson in a while, the sustenance that you gather for that day, to not have bread for tomorrow, the prayer, give us this day our daily bread. Daily bread takes on a new meaning in the wilderness, where there is nothing but sand and rock, and tomorrow's bread is not at all apparent. And there's great lessons for Israel out in the wilderness. You recognize a quote in here, don't you? Where have you heard that?
Jesus' temptation.
Jesus' temptation out in the wilderness. Man does not live by bread alone. That's also, that text is quoted often. It's often in the Old Testament. I think it's in Psalm 105 or Psalm 91. And throughout the Old Testament. Excuse me, I don't think it's in the Psalms. It's in Amos. Anyway, it's sprinkled throughout the Old Testament. Jesus quotes it in the New Testament. The wilderness. At other times that the wilderness became important. You know, very often I find that theme in the wilderness, that the people in the New Testament as well went back to the wilderness to find something.
Temptation story.
The temptation. What was Jesus doing in the wilderness? Why did he go?
Was he not praying?
He was praying. He was preparing himself. And a lot of people say this was Jesus' way of really preparing himself for the ministry.
It says he was sent by the Holy Spirit. He was sent by the Holy Spirit to go into the wilderness.
Okay, and that's Matthew chapter 4. Let's take a look at Matthew talks a lot about the wilderness. Matthew 4. So Jesus goes out into the wilderness. He's sent by the Holy Spirit into the wilderness. Why? To prepare, to fast, to be tempted. Out into the wilderness to be tempted by the devil. And he fasted 40 days and 40 nights. So take a look at the chapter above that. Where does John appear? In the wilderness. The voice of one crying in the wilderness. Paul, after Damascus. He has his experience on the road to Damascus. Where does he go? He doesn't know anything about the Christian faith. Where does one encounter God? He goes to the Arabian desert. And you know, we're told very little about Paul's experience out in the desert in those years. But one there's a great biblical theme that one encounters God most intimately out in the desert. The early Christian fathers, Henry Nouwen, writes about the desert fathers, who in some of the Coptic materials that came out of Egypt, people would go out into the desert and there they would encounter God. Why do you suppose that is? Why do you meet God out in the wilderness, out in the desert?
You're totally dependent on him. You can't do anything by yourself.
Okay. You're dependent on him?
A lot less distractions.
Okay. Yeah. Solitude. You know, the one of the things that the Desert Fathers wrote a lot about was contemplation. Henry Nouwen is really into solitude and contemplation. He talks about that text, pray without ceasing. And what he says is that it really has a lot more to do with silence and contemplation, listening to God. And a lot of really great literature comes out of the desert. There was a book written about the great religions of the world coming out of the desert. I think that's the name of the book, Out of the Desert. Anybody familiar with that? I was trying to look for it in the library, and I wanted to find out what it says. And it talked about Muhammad and Jesus and Judaism and what it was out in the desert that produced all of this theology and Israel's experience with God out in the desert. It became very, very important. Okay, the desert sets the agenda.
There's another thought there, that the wilderness is God's true creation, the way he made it. Buckminster Fuller talks about mankind, since its beginning, has set about to recreate or change creation and make it his own desires, where our city and our square building is going to come from. And it's interesting to think about what he talks about when you walk down to an American city, or any city of the world. You're not exactly in God's creation here. It's quite as likely to meet him.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, out in the wilderness, they were just there. And very vulnerable. Yeah.
In the wilderness, it lasted for 40 years, so people died. And then they started over, and he had a fresh new group. And it was a cleansing time. So would that be part of it? Like the older people that died, and he had a new group there, maybe. By the time they went out of the desert, they were all different people.
Okay. Yeah, there was some that was left, but you have, you know, and a lot of people have written about that and wondered, is it possible for the former slaves to take possession of the promised land? The slave mentality, those people who had been slaves all their lives in Egypt, and you know, in the wilderness served as the breaking point. The wilderness is the arena for the new freedom of the slaves. And it's interesting that they move not from freedom to the promised land, but the training ground for freedom is the wilderness. And, you know, all of the really important lessons are learned by the people of God out in the wilderness. Yeah, the generation, the fact that there is two generations out in the wilderness is terribly important, especially in Deuteronomy, as the preacher stands on the bank of the Jordan River about to enter the promised land. He doesn't reflect so much on Egypt. He reflects on the wilderness and to remember the wilderness when they go into the promised land.
I've been starting to read some of his Henry Now and stuff, mm-hmm. and I have some trouble with it. And as I think of this wilderness experience with the Israelites, on the one hand, there was the need to depend on God and learn that dependence. On the other hand, I think there was a strong element of learning to depend on one another and work together with one another. That's something that I guess as I read the Henry Now and stuff, I feel that people need people, and God has given us to be of help to one another. And we need one another. God has made us that way. I feel that Henry Nouwen's emphasis kind of downplays that. And I haven't read enough to make that kind of a statement with any authority. But I feel that, I feel uncomfortable with this emphasis on solitude and aloneness, and that this is where God meets us. I'm sure that there are those kind of situations, special situations like with the Apostle Paul and with Jesus in the wilderness, but it was a temporary thing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, the experience of the community of Israel out in the wilderness becomes one of entering the wilderness as a rough tribal confederation.
That becomes community.
Yeah. Go ahead.
I was going to go back to Deuteronomy. Mm-hmm. I don't have a problem with, you know, following his commandments and walking his ways, fearing him, fearing God. Mm-hmm. The word fearing, would you, I'm kind of not so comfortable with that word.
To fear him, yeah. I think part of the fear is also a lesson of dependence, but to be God's covenant people, the training ground out in the wilderness is also a time when they really have to learn what it means to follow His covenant, and that you know, God was terribly serious about the things that He had asked the people of Israel to do, and it troubles me too.
Does fear in this sense mean to be afraid?
No. I don't think it doesn't mean to
be afraid of God.
I think it means respect.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but I think that there's an element of genuinely being afraid of the consequences of not following the covenant. The consequences of not following the covenant in the desert are quick. You know, and in that sense, a healthy fear is an important part of your survival kit out in the desert. You know, the foolish person will walk up into the mountains and not be afraid of the mountains or hypothermia, and they get into trouble. You can get into trouble very quickly, and so you know that kind of fear, fear of consequences of being out of the covenant is a good one. Yeah.
Oh, I was just going to say that what I got from the things I've read by Henry Nouwen is that he says that the primary purpose, I guess, for going out into the desert and seeking that solitude is that you finally encounter your naked self, and there's a tremendous pain and fear and agony that's involved in that, and that you can no longer run from yourself or hide from yourself. And we, you know, in our whole society, everything we this within our society is set up as a means in which we can run and hide from ourselves, from you know our naked self, which is totally dependent. And I guess it's that battle and that wrestling that's very extremely painful, I guess. That's what I got the impression he was talking about. And then there's a rebirth that occurs out of that. So when you come back out of the desert, you are a new person.
Do you think the people of Israel encountered themselves out in the desert?
Yeah, I would say in the same way that he was talking about.
What did they find out about themselves?
I think all through history, way before the time of Christ, it has been a custom of cultures to send their young at puberty out into the wilderness for a short time or a week or a month, and that in that time they become mature. And it's often a ceremonial rite of that change from a child to a man, especially the man. But it's symbolic of the fact that there comes a time when I have to know who I really am. And that will feel like a wilderness because I'll stumble and fall and complain and see the pain of knowing that there's negativity there. But then if I make it, I've survived the initiation rite. And to me, that's what welds communities, is going through that stuff.
Yeah.
Plus, when you get to the point where you're beginning to see who you are and you're facing these negative things and these fears, the important thing is to not be afraid. Because that way, he knows our frame. He is mindful of everything that we are, all the things that we don't want to look at, that I don't want to know about myself. He already knows it. So when I get to that point, he's already there. And sometimes you have to be in the wilderness to get away from the distractions to get to that point, and then realize that he is already there, and he loves you just the way you are. But he loves you too much to leave you that way.
How about that lesson? Man does not live by bread alone. Are we aware of that? What was the lesson of that out in the wilderness? I mean, I would think in the wilderness you would begin to learn that you live by bread.
Yeah, he took it away from him and made the manna.
Okay, that he took the bread there.
He took everything away and said, okay, now it's manna, day to day.
And that's how, so I'm not sure how that helped them see that you don't live by bread.
You have to depend on God.
You look at total creation.
Yeah.
Live by total creation.
The man didn't become a living being until God breathed into him the spirit, the breath, and we realize and see that we are body and spirit, and both are essential to this life.
Doesn't say that we don't need bread. It just says that bread by itself isn't enough.
That's the word of God. Okay. A lot has been made out of the cycle in the wilderness, the cycle of the people grumble and complain. Can anybody remember what that cycle is? The people grumble and complain. They turn to Moses. God sends some kind of deliverance. He meets their needs. And then pretty soon they grumble and complain again, right? And it keeps going. Oh, Moses talks to God about it.
Good examples of that all over. Exodus chapter 11. One of the things about being out in the desert, you're out there without resources, and probably the most frustrating thing is that you're out there without a plan. You know, and you go from oasis to oasis, and there doesn't seem to be leadership, and you know, all of those tremendously frustrating things for the people. A great crisis, and everyone wants to be a leader and can run the operation better than the person. And I think part of the lesson of the wilderness is a lesson in leadership. And I don't know how many of you read the tragic incident of the little boy that fell in the well in Italy. The last couple, and what happened in terms of leadership in the rescue operation was almost as tragic. And the rescuers made some mistakes, and time was desperate, and people shouted suggestions, and everyone wanted to have a better idea of how to get out of that fix. Same thing takes place out in the wilderness. You know, the resources are limited. They aren't there, and they're out there without a plan. And the capacity for griping and hollering suggestions and wanting to go back to the flesh pots of Egypt, where at least things were dependable. Slavery was better than that.
We may be giving a wrong impression of the wilderness, and I think many people here who have been into the wilderness would not say it's a place to fear. And even our history of our country would say that our people have not feared the wilderness, that they've headed into it at every opportunity and in large droves, and that there is no real wilderness that doesn't have someone in it someplace that's there by choice. My own personal experience is that I would much rather be in the wilderness than I would be in Los Angeles. As we're portraying it here, it has to be a place to fear. As a matter of fact, it would be just the opposite. It would be a place to rejoice and be glad to be there.
Maybe if you knew how to take care of yourself.
Well, our first trip there, we didn't know.
Well, it depends on whether you're talking about a wilderness like Holden or a wilderness like the desert. Oh, yeah.
In the Sinai Desert,
both
die
straight,
die in both places.
Right, but it's a lot nicer to die in a wilderness like Holden.
Yeah, the crunch of exposure out in the Judean desert and the lack of water. But you're right, I suppose Los Angeles is also a wilderness, but a wilderness in a different sort, and people die
the worst wilderness
of exposure in Los Angeles too. Without shelter. Go ahead.
This we need each other is not an absolute. There are people, and I used to live in Alaska, and there are people who live an enormous amount of distance from anyone else that function very well. Mm-hmm. We have created a situation where we need each other. That may be out of fear, not the other way around.
Okay, but some of the lessons that Israel does learn out in the Sinai Desert is one of cooperation with one another because of the burden of this. You know, a person can go out into the wilderness. You need some kind of education to be out there. You know, we're talking about a band of former slaves, and their exposure and understanding of the wilderness is really limited. They're not even used to providing for themselves in the flesh pots of Egypt. They have disengaged themselves from Egypt, which not only was a taskmaster, but also a provider. And now out there having to provide for themselves in a new way without resources or experience of knowing how to do that. But I understand what you're saying about the wilderness, and I think sometimes that's the reason why people have gone back out into the wilderness to discover some of those things for themselves. But there's no backstop for the people of Israel. God has got to be the backstop for the people of Israel. Numbers chapter 11, Moses then talks to God. He is also complaining. What does he say in verse 11? Can someone read that? Nice complaint there.
Hey, Moses has really got the burden on his back, the responsibility for leadership out in the desert. The people look to Moses. He's doing, they don't like his leadership, and really complain. And then Moses complains to God. Yeah.
We're talking about wilderness, and I get the feeling that we're describing rocks and trees, rocks and sky and things. But I'm looking at it from a wilderness within more. And Moses has here come up against his own wilderness, his own inadequacy. It's empty. I can't do it. I don't have it within me to provide what these people are would have been asked of me. So I see him meeting his wilderness within, not just his wilderness without. I think there's a two-level thing there.
Yeah, Moses feels, really doesn't, in the tough times, he really doesn't want the responsibility for the whole people. But you can see he feels it very much. He feels responsible for all of these people.
It's a tremendous number of people, too. And you think about wilderness, and you take 1.5 million people into the wilderness, it's like a nomadic Los Angeles, wilderness anymore. The loneliness is only from within.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the people are going, they're kind of going from oasis to oasis, and I imagine when they move into an oasis, they take over the whole show. There's, if anybody was there camped by the oasis and this band walked in, well, they had to take care of it. Okay, the Lord's response this time is to try and get the people a little better organized in verse 16. And he responds and he sends them quails then at the end of chapter 11. Exodus chapter 16. Another story of feeding in the wilderness. I'm sure this one's Exodus. And this one is very important because it's the story of the manna, and manna and the bread from heaven takes on real spiritual significance for the people of Israel. And the text, you remember what God taught you, that man does not live by bread alone. And Jesus' miracles of the bread in Matthew 13, I think it is, Matthew 14, Jesus takes the people out into the wilderness and they are without bread. And I really think it's referring back to this story in Exodus chapter 16. Jesus is very much aware of this. Exodus 16, would someone start reading up to verse 5?
They set out from Edom, and all the congregation of the people of Israel came to the wilderness of Sin, which is between Edom and Sinai, on the 15th day of the second month after they had departed from the land of Egypt. And the whole congregation of the people of Israel murmured against Moses and Aaron in the wilderness, and said to them, would that we had died by the hand of the Lord in the land of Egypt, when we sat by the flesh pots and ate bread with the full, for you have brought us out into this wilderness to kill this whole assembly with hunger. And the Lord said to Moses, behold, I will rain bread from heaven for you, and the people shall go out and gather a day's portion every day, that I may prove them whether they will walk in my law or not. On the sixth day, when they prepare what they bring in, it will be twice as much as they gather daily.
Okay, what's how much do they gather? Enough for the day, and no more. And the lesson of daily bread out in the wilderness becomes extremely important. And also the Sabbath takes on importance. The trouble with being in the city and being in the new land is that there is no time for the Sabbath. You're storing up bread, you're keeping bread, but out in the wilderness, the manna is provided on the sixth day so that you may also rest on the seventh day. and the story continues. The people go out and gather. And then I think it's very significant, verse 17 and 18. A new system of economics out in the wilderness. This is wilderness economics, 17 and 18. Could someone read that, please?
And the people of Israel did so. They gathered some more, some less. But when they measured it with an omer, he that gathered much had nothing over, and he that gathered little had no lack. Each gathered according to what he could eat.
All right. That is a new kind of economics. Some gathered more, some gathered less. And it's a, you know, it's not capitalism, it's not communism, it's, you know, everyone takes, but they all have need of that. And what do you think is being learned here? What's the lesson in that?
Enough is enough.
What happens in the city? You know, in the promised land, out of the wilderness.
We waste.
We gather. Mm-hmm. Yeah. We continue to gather. We gather not only enough for today, but we want to hedge against tomorrow. And so we're gathering for tomorrow too. And these are tough words, you know, as I read this in our culture and, you know, think about my life insurance policy and my bets against the future that I have made and my hedging and, you know, read about them gathering just enough for that day. It's they're in the city, in the promised land, the economic system works differently. You gather more for tomorrow. You gather for next week, and you're thinking about the day after tomorrow. But out in the wilderness, you gather for the day. And it's a whole different kind of system, and people gather less. And then some people gather more, and some people gather less. And each person is satisfied. The problem with living in the promised land is that, what about satisfaction? You're never satisfied. You know, you've gathered that in, and maybe you've got enough for tomorrow. Well, you want enough for the end of the week, and then that's not enough. If it's available and it's possible to get, you're going to gather it for the next week too. And so the problem of living in the city in the promised land is that you're never satisfied. You know, that hymn, I think the old version ended, "Feed me till I want no more." And in the city, that's not possible. Because the wants and the needs, what's the part of your definition of economics, Mark? An endless?
Yeah, the definition of economics is that because of human nature, we say we have unlimited wants. They're insatiable, unlimited wants. And the problem is we have limited resources that nature creates. And so economists try to figure out how to produce as many wants as possible with those limited resources. So we're efficiency experts. We're always trying to find a way to meet an insatiable desire for goods and services.
Okay. So Exodus chapter 16, verses 17 to 18 suggests a different order of economics, right?
Right.
No, the wilderness economics, right?
Psychologically, that's true too, because some people need more affection and stimulation, mm-hmm. and they have nothing left over. And those who need less do with less. It's very similar. Mm-hmm. The psychic economy.
That's what I was thinking that he was reading. She was reading.
I think we should read it again, because isn't there some indication that even though they gathered more, that means they didn't necessarily mean they used it, and the one that gathered less had enough to be filled? That's what I was thinking. It's a psychological thing. The person who needed more gathered more, but did they just need it mentally, not physically?
I don't get that impression. I'll read it from my version. They gathered it, some more, some less. And when they measured it, an omer, what they had gathered, the man who had gathered more had not too much. The man who had gathered less had not too little. Each found he had gathered what he needed. And what happens then, the next verses, what happens to the people that are trying to gather more?
Too much.
Some would not listen to Moses. They kept part of it for the following day. It bred maggots. It smelled bad. And Moses was angry with them. Morning by morning, they gathered it, each according to his needs. And when the sun grew hot, it dissolved. Well, I'm not sure it could dissolve, smell bad, and get maggots, but you get the idea. Yeah. Daily bread. That's the lesson in the wilderness. Daily bread. And it's really important. Okay. They called it manna. Then, verse 32. Here's a very strange command. Wilderness bread. For the wilderness bread. Can someone read verse 32 till the end of chapter 16?
And Moses said, "This is what the Lord has commanded. Let an omer of it be kept throughout your generation, that they may see the bread with which I fed you in the wilderness. And I brought you out of the land of Egypt." And Moses said to Aaron, "Take a jar and put an omer of manna in it, and place it before the Lord to be kept throughout your generation. As the Lord commanded Moses, so Aaron placed it before testimony to be kept. And the people of Israel ate the manna 40 years till they came to a habitable land. They ate the manna till they came to the border of the land of Canaan. And omer is the tenth part of the
whole five." That should be helpful.
Okay, so they get these little souvenir jars. They get these little souvenir jars and they stuff some of the manna into the jar, and it gets kept in the Ark of the Covenant. Why keep wilderness bread?
Remembrance.
And see, you know, if God can make it keep for 40 years, this is why you say, "I don't know how it can melt and rot at the same time." God's doing it. He can make it do whatever he wants it to do. If he wants to be kept for 40 years as a visual, a reminder. I mean, some people need to be visually, I mean, it needs to rot before they'll believe it. This is God's rule. And it needs to be kept for 40 years before they'll believe this is God keeping it.
Okay, what, yeah, the point is, it's kept for 40 years. 40, you know, in the Bible, it becomes a very symbolical number of completion, 40 years in the wilderness. Keep it for 40 years, 40 days. Jesus fasted, lots of 40s. Keep the wilderness bread. What are the children supposed to learn from the wilderness bread? That God is providing, that they're supposed to learn dependency and trust. You know, and I'm wondering if we have any wilderness bread left over to take a look at anymore. Have we saved any wilderness bread?
There is a theory of what that was, manna was. Everyone's familiar with it, and it may be wrong. That this is byproduct that a certain type of locust and the yeast drought, and it has some characteristics of what they describe, and still is in existence. The locust. Have you heard that?
Yeah, I've heard little bits and pieces about it. I'm very unfamiliar with that.
And it's quite reasonable when you examine it. God could create large supply of locusts to fly over a lifetime and deposit these droppings.
What are we having for dinner tonight? Oh, what is
Yeah, go ahead.
Just to be serious about what you're asking, I think it must be the Old Testament.
Well, I think it is the New Testament.
Sort of part of our jar of wilderness bread.
Right. I think it's the Ten Commandments. Not the law. I don't mean that, you know, here's the law, but I just mean that God took care of these people. If we don't learn that lesson from the wilderness, if we don't have that, if that isn't our bread of life, then my father. And then, of course, the next covenant, the most important one of all. I see Jesus in the wilderness. Jesus is the bread of life.
Manna becomes the symbol of the wilderness, the experience of the wilderness, the souvenir bread jar, and it's there's so much embodied in there. When Jesus calls himself the bread of life,